got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Cameron and Kevin back with you for another episode. Kevin, what's going on this beautiful Friday?
Well, lots happening in the world of COVID-19, as you probably would have guessed.
Yeah, I'm thinking of changing the name of the podcast to the Coronavirus COVID-19 Show, because it's just like all we talk about. But
that's essential, because right now there is so much bad information out there and so much false information that we need to be pumping the correct scientific evidence-based information out there just to give people interested in science something to talk about and to counter the bad information. It's a hot topic. It's going to be a hot topic for a while. It's good for us to be giving good information. So I hope people appreciate that and don't think we're focusing too much on the big disaster of the day.
Yeah, definitely. Of course, I can't disagree with that. I was just trying to have a pity party, and Kevin's being the responsible educator of the two of us. So yes,
anyways, that's what I do.
So to the four stories we're going to talk about today, there's finally a drug for COVID-19, but the big question is how well does it work? So we're going to look at some of the clinical data that's starting to come in. And then anti-GMO groups are blaming industrial agriculture, quote unquote, for coronavirus. And so we're going to dive in and explain why this probably is a baseless claim. Moving on, people are more inclined to trust their gut, even when they know their gut is probably wrong. So we're going to look at a study that tried to explain why this phenomenon happens. And finally, a farmer in South Africa has been accused of witchcraft for growing GM corn. And to do my best clickbaity intro, I'm just going to say, you'll never guess what happened next. Anyway, but to the more important news is that this is from the New York Times, emergency FDA authorization of remdesivir expected after experimental coronavirus drug shows promise in trial. Whew, that was a long introduction. Let's see, the mortality rate for people that take the drug, it's like 3.5% lower, I think. So it's a good start maybe, but it's really not going to bring this thing to an end. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Well, mortality was not the endpoint they were looking at. And so it's even rough to go there because you're looking at people who are already compromised with the disease, with the virus. And so you can't necessarily make a good measurement about mortality on that. What they did show is that it decreased the severity and the duration of the symptoms, and mostly the decrease in the symptoms from 15 days average to 11 days average. And that's a pretty positive thing. However, all of this with a grain of salt, because it is a non-peer-reviewed bioarchive type study and yet has to go through all of those steps before it could be taken seriously. At the same time, they were small studies. So Fauci, in all of his wisdom, says these are suggestive, not definitive, something to be optimistic about, but not excited about. And I think that's a good synopsis.
Now, the FDA gave this an emergency authorization. So do you know what happens next? Do they continue doing clinical work to see if they can get a better effect from this drug, or do they just start letting doctors prescribe it?
Well, I think what it is that it allows you to use the drug in clinical trials that are not planned. So in other words, nobody sat down for the year before and carefully planned out exactly how many people of what ethnic groups and what your pools would look like and who would get the placebo and who wouldn't, how it's blinded. All those things are usually worked out ahead of time. And then you have institutional review, all these things. This kind of FDA emergency declaration says you have a population of sick people. Let's use the drug and see how it works with them. Remdesivir is not a drug from outer space. It's something that's understood to some degree, how it's safe and tolerated. And so now the question is, does it work in someone who's showing symptoms of the disease?
still pretty impressive. I mean, we're about 3.5 months into this and we've already got a drug that has some therapeutic effect. So that's a good sign. But it seems like the running theme through all of this is, well, incremental steps forward and we still don't know long term. So we just have to keep following the data as it comes out. So that's still encouraging nonetheless. But let's take a look at our next story. And this is a real fascinating topic to me, Kevin. Blame the coronavirus on industrial agriculture. We need more, not less of it to stave off the next viral pandemic. And this is Andrew Porterfield writing originally for us at Genetic Literacy Project. So what do you think of this article, Kevin?
Well, it follows a very similar pattern. If something goes wrong in the world, it probably has to do with GM crops, and ultimately probably Monsanto. But since that company doesn't exist anymore, it's easy to point a finger at industrial agriculture as kind of the straw man, right? This is the cause of all your ills. And it's the same old players, once again, reiterating the same message they've always reiterated, and not realizing that actually they're saying something that is completely contrary to what the reality needs to be. And so we can talk about that more in detail as we go along. But the bottom line is, it's the same old, same old. Industrialized agriculture is the root of all the problems.
Right. And we talked last week a little bit about how everybody just utilizes this pandemic to flog their favorite topic, whatever it is, you know. So if you hate the government, well, you know, coronavirus proves the government sucks. And, you know, if you love the government, well, it proves, you know, the government's awesome. And same thing with these people, right, is that they always love organic agriculture. And then all of a sudden, it's like, hey, guess what we need more of, guys? Organic agriculture. You know, I just find that a little frustrating. But I think the biggest point to me is that if we were to actually follow the advice that groups like the Organic Consumers Association put forward, we would actually be putting ourselves at greater risk for pandemics. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, sure. That's what's really interesting about this, is that they call for a, you know, ban on industrial agriculture and for everybody to pick up a hoe and start getting at it. And, you know, the problem is really what we need is sustainable intensification. All of the issues, whether it was HIV, you know, which came from people consuming bushmeat, or from avian influenza, which comes from birds in zoonotic transfer. Other cases in this, like COVID-19, which originated from bats in wet markets. All of these cases came from the expansion of agriculture in different areas where, you know, you're moving into animal territory. And, you know, actually all three critics mentioned this, and they're partially right. As you begin to continue to expand acreage, you start to encroach on nature. And this is where these zoonotic events take place, at that animal-human interface. The problem is that the answer is not to abandon industrial farming. What it is to contract and constrain farming to the smallest space you can by intensifying on the space you have. And that takes new genetics and new crop protection strategies.
Sure. And one thing I'll add on the animal side of things, because this is another big gripe of theirs, is that, you know, you put all these animals together on a big factory farm and then, you know, the world melts down. I actually had a veterinarian on this show last year. And she went through how an actual animal farm works and, you know, different protections they have in place. And so they're using vaccines. They're making sure the animals are eating well. They have air conditioned barns in many cases. You know, the cows can actually milk themselves, in the sense that they can walk up to a machine that milks them when they're ready. And so there's a lot of technology that goes into a modern, quote unquote, industrial farm. And the problem actually is that you have countries with low food safety standards and underdeveloped agricultural sectors. And that's where these outbreaks tend to pop up, you know, country like Mexico or China or some of these other places, because they're just not as developed yet. And so that's a point to stress, is that the more technological your farming gets, the less likely this is, just to underscore that point that basically they have it exactly backwards.
No, you're exactly right. What's really cool, another good point to build on what you said, you know, cows, many of them in beef production and dairy wear a Fitbit. You know, they wear telemetry that follows when they eat, when they lay down, where they go, and cows are remarkably adherent to patterns. And so when you see breaks in the pattern, it means something might be wrong with that animal. So it allows for surveillance and medical oversight of herds to be at an unprecedented resolution. And so why they can easily criticize this? Factories exist because factories are efficient. And so when you say factory farm, it means to me efficient farm, not my wife's farm, you know, where she's out there toiling in the hot sun. This is streamlined and it's for a different purpose. And it's to keep food inexpensive so that the food insecure and that the relative and the poor can afford to eat. And that's a good thing about industrial agriculture.
Absolutely. And one final point before we move on, the Breakthrough Institute had a related article, and I don't think Andrew made the exact same point, but what Breakthrough said is with industrial agriculture, you just produce more food. There's really no question about it because you can look at the yield data from all over the world. And so if you can grow more food on less land, then people are less likely to go hunting for bats or pangolins, which are, of course, as you mentioned, these are the animals that harbor these diseases. And so again, over and over, we're saying it, but we need more of this, not less of this. I think that's the important takeaway here. So, all right, let's move on to this new study. And this is fascinating. This is from the world of psychology. So why do people trust their gut instinct even when it's not the smart choice? And I believe this is a study from Ohio State University. So introduce this, Kevin, because I think there's some important takeaways from this too.
Yeah, this is really cool. And the more I thought about this, as it applies to gambling and sports and superstition. And what it is that people who have a gut feeling or some sort of habit that they go through, they trust that more than what they know works by intuition, or like not intuition, by evidence. So the gut feeling overrides evidence. And the way that they figured this out was by looking at people's choices in a computer game. And you made money by getting right answers. So the first level of the game gave people a very simple choose, you know, left or right, where some items moved, and it followed a pattern that was very easy to decipher. So in round two, they would automatically gravitate to that same pattern, thinking that it would apply again, even though there's no reason to believe that it would. And what it showed is that in round two, there was no pattern. Yet in round three, they still would follow the pattern, even though they were introduced to a different pattern or no pattern. So the idea is that ingrained gut feeling as learned by the original trial overweighed what they would see from additional evidence.
The funny part to me is that in the round of the trial where they didn't change the pattern, people still followed it only 40% of the time, even though it wasn't trying to toy with them. It was just them, their own intuition going, oh, you know, I better try something different. So less than half the time, even when there was no reason to change, they were still changing. It was really fascinating. It kind of reminded me of that scene from Ron Burgundy where the guy goes, 60% of the time it works all the time. It's the same kind of like, you know, numerical ignorance, I guess you could say. But the big point, and you sort of touched on this, I think, is that making data-driven decisions is really difficult because when you're looking around at the world, it's hard to take in everything and then remember everything that's happened and try to, I guess, calculate what the right decision is. Can you comment on that? Obviously, as a scientist, you're probably better at this than most people.
Well, what we think about is humans are pattern seekers, right? We look for patterns in the clouds. The whole idea of pareidolia, of constructing an image or constructing auditory information, playing a Led Zeppelin record backwards. This is, listening for the satanic message. All of those things are pareidolia. They're the mind searching for patterns where something might be. Because if we have a pattern, it gives us something to make further judgments on. And the leader of the study, this guy, I think his name is Krabich, is how you pronounce it. It says, it can be hard to judge whether you made a good or bad decision based just on the outcome. We can make a good decision and just get unlucky and have a bad outcome, or we can make bad decisions and get lucky and have a good outcome. So the patterns that we trust can oftentimes fail us. And I think that was the major idea here, that the idea of the gut instinct not always being the thing that should be trusted.
Do you think that this might help explain why you have certain segments of society that are so skeptical of science? and I'm, and you know all the people I'm talking about, of course, but you present them with statistical data or, you know, or like with the yields on organic versus conventional crops, and you say, you know, you get this percentage increase over each hectare, blah, 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 blah. And they don't really care because they have their own experiences or these anecdotes from their friends, and they just are not convinced by that. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, I think that it's a little different than this. I think what that relies on is who do you trust? And people trust their gut, right? They trust their instinct. This is talking about this phenomenon from the side of established patterns translating into future patterns. Whereas what you're referring to, I think, is the trust that you see in a given organization or a person who you believe or something that you've heard from a trusted source. This is what shapes our perception, is who we believe. And that's based on a whole range of different factors, from reliability and competence and intimacy and your motivations. You know, there's all kinds of things that go into trust. And this study basically says that there's a role for patterns in that as well. And people do not always understand how much of a role they play.
Cool. Now, before we move on, is there a flip side to this? In other words, do you think you can try to rely too much on a statistical way of thinking when you're trying to make decisions? Can you overcompensate, in other words?
Yeah, well, I think you can. And, you know, we could get into all kinds of details here about things like profiling and other issues that, you know, you have a gut feeling about something, yet your intuition says something very different. You know, that's a Doberman. And I know Dobermans, you know, are dangerous, because in the 1970s, they were on every single after school special about the dogs that would kill somebody or something. You know, you have this gut that's shaped by all these gut feelings that are shaped by all this old evidence and preliminary data. And it overrides the fact that we know that maybe these animals are just fine. The gut sometimes overrides that. So there's a lot to that. And it's a really important aspect of human psychology.
All right. So maybe just slow down and think through things a little bit as you're making important decisions throughout your life. Maybe that's the best takeaway.
Well, yeah, following evidence never takes you the wrong direction. The question is then, what evidence do you trust? And so that's where we start getting into those other layers.
Right, right. And I'm sure we'll explore that more since we talk about communication all the time. But this next headline, this is maybe one of my favorite headlines I've ever written. GMO success story: South African farmer accused of witchcraft after achieving 1600% corn yield increase. And this is from the African Agricultural Technology Foundation. So jump in here, please, Kevin.
Well, this is, from African Agriculture Technology. A gentleman named Mr. Sam Mabella, he's a vegetable farmer in South Africa, and he has gone from a very low harvest to a very high harvest in a short period of time. It turns out that there is a significant challenge to farming in South Africa. They've had problems with a sporadic drought, but also fall armyworm. And fall armyworm is this devastating insect where the larvae cover the field like a blanket, destroy everything in their path, and they spin a little web, and the wind grabs them and can take them as far as 60 kilometers away to recolonize the next area. It's from the west, and is now a problem in Africa. And people sometimes talk about fall armyworm with the idea of famine in the sentence. So Mr. Mabella planted corn that came from what was called the Wema corn, which was a water-efficient maize that now has BT. So this is the protein from bacteria that make it resistant to insects. And he planted this corn, and he went from one drum, or 200 kilograms of maize, to in 1.5 hectares, to 17 drums, which is a 1600% increase. And folks in the neighborhoods have accused him of being a witch, because that's the only way you could beat insects, right?
Right, right. Well, you know, if you're from a place where you don't have access to this technology, you know, the logic might dictate. You're like, well, what are you doing that the rest of us aren't? You know, but the best part of the story is that the chief of the village came by because he was like, why are all these people saying you're doing witchcraft? And then he saw all this corn and he goes, look at all this maize, and ended up buying like 3 or 4 barrels of it for himself, you know? So I love this story. But the thing I love most about it is, this is the kind of anecdote that will really put a dent in the activist narrative that they're trying to sell, that this stuff is dangerous. It doesn't increase your yields. You know, the farmers themselves, and then of course the consumers who are going to be able to eat versus going hungry, you know, they're not going to buy into those stories as much about, you know, GMO crops making them sterile or causing cancer, because all they're seeing is like, well, you know, I have food now. So I guess that's okay, right? You know? So anyways, that's encouraging to me.
Well, it is me too. And it's funny because I actually was at a rally, and this is a while ago, probably like 2012, at a anti-GMO rally where I was invited as the scientist to be speaking. And people started shouting me down, and one person accused me of being a witch. So I share something with Mr. Mabea.
So what makes you a witch exactly? Is it just that you advocate for biotechnology?
Oh no, I'm a scientist who talks about science, and that was you know, that was enough to get me in the and the thing is, how do I know I'm not?
Well, as long as you do it on your own time and you're not hurting anybody, you know, what's the big deal? So,
well, you know, doesn't it depend if you can swim? if they throw you in the river and you sink, you're a witch.
Oh, I'm dying over here.
Yeah. No. If you sink, you're not a witch, and if you swim, you're a witch. So they kill you. Right. Yeah, if you drown, you were innocent. Yeah. Anyway,
I have no idea. I can't keep track. I can barely keep track of the serious stuff that I need to understand, and for these kind of things. But
no. This is a legitimate thing. This is how they tested if you were a witch in the Salem witch trials. Is that they would throw you in the river, and then if you drowned, then you were not a witch and you were innocent. And if you swam and lived, then you were a witch, and so they burned you at the stake.
So yeah, that I love both outcomes, right? Because they all work out in your favor. But in all seriousness, this is just one story, Kevin. But would you say that his experience reflects generally what people see with this BT technology in different crops? And it's been put into all kinds, like it's in corn and cotton and brinjal and others. But is this story just one example of many?
I think for people who are living with the threat of things like fall armyworm, and we talked about the massive swarms of locusts that are destroying crops in the Horn of Africa and East Africa. When you have genetics that can give the plant resistance, you have a tool, and you may not have access to pesticides. You may not have access to other methods to control the insects. So having the plant protect itself is almost a witchcraft. It's almost a godsend. It is technology that allows you to grow food. And then that we've seen that, as you mentioned, in a number of crops, and this is no exception.
Awesome. And I think that's the great story that I'd love to end our podcast on, is some big exciting news, you know, because with coronavirus, it's not always that exciting because it's like, it's still killing people and we sort of have a drug, but we don't. But with this, it's like a great ending. It's like a Pixar movie or something, you know? So anyways, good stuff. Kevin, what's going on in your world? What's going on in Talking Biotech?
Well, Talking Biotech, we're focusing on coronavirus. And the next episodes or recent episodes that you'll hear have to do with the idea of the coronavirus vaccine Manhattan Project. How do we get to a vaccine in 6 months? And then we also talked to an epidemiologist and biostatistician who dissolves many of the myths around the coronavirus. And she talks about the fact that by relaxing our distancing and relaxing the standards and care that we're taking, we're setting ourselves up for a massive outbreak and pretty substantial deaths. So rather dire predictions from somebody who knows this stuff really well.
Yep. And as always, listen to the experts. All right, Kevin, what's your Twitter handle, Facebook? Connect with the people.
Yeah, so I'm at Kevin Folta at Twitter at KevinFolta, and on Facebook at Kevin M. Folta. M like make me a witch. Kevin M. Folta. That's my professional Facebook page. And of course, the Talking Biotech podcast.
Great stuff. So you get callback humor and you learn a little bit of science on this show. What more could you ask for? So check out the show at geneticliteracyproject.org. And I am at CamJEnglish on Twitter. And as always, we'll see you next week. Thank you so much.